As we get this item to kind of explain the book, talk about why you came to this, some of the key ideas in it. I'll ask some questions, but you're recording it too, Tim. It's being recorded. If you don't want to be recorded when you ask a question, I can mute mine and Tony can, I don't know, hide his or something. And then, ask some questions and we'll do a Q&A. And if you've got something that you think kind of adds in to the conversation, give me a point at me instead of putting your hands up, and we'll kind of I'll jump around. I think because we're talking about Manchester in Bristol, I think it's kind of helpful for us to try and have those local kind of examples. I've already lined Ben up to tell me a bit about Cardiff as well. We can talk about all the places nearby. I think that would be lead to a more productive conversation. Just do that, and we'll be good to go. All right. Without further ado,
comments welcome.
Yeah, exactly. We want questions and comments at once. So without further ado, I'm going to pass over to Isaac Rose to tell you about his book, and then we'll come back.
Thanks, Isaac.
No worries.
Thanks for inviting me. Thanks for having me. Wonderful to be here. I've actually only once been to Bristol before, so this is it's very wonderful to properly be here for a night in the city. Kind of got myself in the mood before coming here to go to look at the plinth of the Colston statue. It's very nice to see. So my book is a book about Manchester. It's a sort of a book about its contemporary housing crisis, I suppose, kind of in a very simple terms, but then kind of contextualizing that within 200 years of history of the city. and I suppose, for those of you who aren't familiar with Manchester or haven't been there in some time, over the last kind of 10 years in Manchester, there's been a really quite astonishing kind of building boom, skyscrapers popping up, lots and lots of build to rent, corporate landlords, blocks being built, particularly in the last 10 years, particularly in the period after the financial crisis. The way in which they've been able to kind of get the cities kind of moving again has been by stoking this property boom, this kind of real estate boom in the city centre. But that really is a sort of, it's been a very deliberately created and deliberately kind of stoked property boom by figures within the local state, kind of since the late 80s, basically. So as a sort of response to deindustrialisation, Manchester City Council and kind of figures within the local business elite decided to kind of embrace this kind of property-led regeneration strategy in the city centre, and they did it kind of with remarkable success to some extent, particularly in the last 10 years. And basically, I think, that story in Manchester, there were kind of two reasons really for writing the book. One was because within Manchester and within the discourse about Manchester, this is seen as a very kind of good thing. And there's a lot of celebratory kind of discourse around what they've done in Manchester, around it being this kind of miracle, this kind of, economic kind of, miracle, economic success story. And I kind of felt that, my day job is working for the Greater Manchester Tenants Union. So I'm kind of through that work really kind of seeing day to day the impacts of gentrification, rent rises and so on in neighbourhoods of inner city Manchester. So it was kind of clear that there was a very one-sided narrative being told about the city and about the kind of, celebratory narrative around the current boom. So it felt really important to kind of put out that kind of critical look at what's going on contemporarily. But also I think the way in which that story is told within the city's own kind of mythology, so Manchester's kind of great at sort of mythologizing its own history and kind of pulling out kind of a particular quite narrow version of it, of its history, particularly since the 80s, around this idea that there was the kind of the music scene, and then that kind of led inextricably towards a kind of property boom. That to me also seemed fairly limited as an understanding. So a lot of the book, the last half of the book, is really looking at the restructuring of the local state and the increasing role of private actors within the local state in kind of creating that boom quite deliberately rather than it being this kind of magical thing that, you know, I think some commentators would make it seem. So that was the kind of one motivation, was to kind of provide that critical and kind of analytical look at, you know, obviously from a kind of left-wing perspective at what's happened in Manchester. But the second motivation really is because I think what's happening in Manchester is obviously echoed and replicated in cities all around England, or all around Britain, and certainly kind of doing this tour over the last few months, you know, going to Glasgow, going to Liverpool, Leeds, and indeed Bristol as well, we can see, I think, the way in which this kind of growth of a kind of build-to-rent sector and a kind of build-to-rent led urban regeneration model, often tying in like a neoliberalised or marketised university sector as well, which in Manchester is really the main story of kind of what they're doing in the south of the city, is clearly the kind of thing that's happening in cities all around Britain and towns, particularly outside of London. It seems like that kind of growth of a rentierism and the growth of corporate landlordism and a growth of kind of institutional capital coming in to build rental blocks, to sort of take advantage of the housing crisis, and take advantage of the fact that housing is so unaffordable, is basically being promoted as the kind of only game in town in terms of like regional economic development. Certainly, stuff like Levelling Up, a lot of that money and a lot, you know, is going towards these kind of schemes, and I would certainly predict to some extent that this will be a core part of how Keir Starmer will probably look to kind of govern a kind of economic boom. All this rhetoric around builders, not blockers, and so on and so forth. Seems pretty clear that this model that is in Manchester, you can kind of look at the story of Manchester and look at how that has come in a very particular kind of local, kind of path-dependent way, also throws light on, I think, a broader trend of kind of how the economy is moving, how capital, you know, where capital is moving into rentierism rather than production or anything like that, the incentives towards build to rent and so on and so forth. So that story in Manchester, we can, you know, we've structured this around a load of questions basically, so we'll get into the detail. But that story, I think, by looking at Manchester, you can get a case study that helps you understand other places in the country and understand these kind of broader trends of how, like, you know, the shift to the asset economy, the shift to rentierism, and the urban neoliberalism and austerity, how all these things are kind of coming together in a way that's reshaping the geography of our cities, in a way that I think is broadly kind of negative, particularly from a kind of working class perspective. In terms of kind of gentrification and these other effects, those negative effects that are kind of coming from that. So that's kind of that. And I guess the beauty of kind of thinking about Manchester as a city is obviously it has this kind of almost paradigmatic state within the origins of industrial capitalism. So the first bit of the book really kind of situates that kind of long rise and fall of the kind of industrial economy in Manchester, as an almost way of thinking about these kind of broader 200-year or certainly like 100-year shifts from a kind of capitalist system that was kind of focused on commodity production towards one that's more in kind of the global north, at least, dealing with kind of speculation in land, real estate, and so on and so forth. So Manchester provides that kind of nice case study for thinking about much broader trends. And I suppose the last thing to kind of say is that the transition from a sort of industrial economy, society, Manchester, through to this kind of property-led regeneration one, I really like situate that within the story of the defeat of the urban left within the 80s by Thatcher, and the kind of, you know, forced rollout of neoliberalism on an urban scale by the Thatcher administration. And I think that again is a way of pushing back at some of the discourse around, you know, why Manchester's leaders decided to embrace a kind of entrepreneurial urbanism, which I think if you listen to sort of you know, bourgeois critics, then they would say, like, you know, they basically realised that this was the sensible thing to do, and that their prior kind of flirtations with municipal socialism or kind of urban radicalism were really misguided, and they kind of did this U-turn. And that's an interesting story in Manchester which you can get into, of how these very same leaders who came to power kind of on a left platform kind of do this switch to urban entrepreneurialism at the end of the 80s. But actually what I really wanted to focus in was this story of political defeat, really, and how out of the political defeat of, you know, the new urban left in the 80s, but also the wider labour movement, that sort of neoliberal agenda was kind of birthed, I suppose, out of that defeat. So the Manchester model, or the kind of rentier city, is the product of a kind of a long political defeat by kind of the urban left. I can leave it there.
Wow. Right, thank you very much. So, like, yeah, I guess, like, I'm going to try and, although desperately reorganising my questions to do this, like, try and kind of follow the book a bit chronologically. So, like, sort of early on, you sort of talk about how Manchester is, in some ways, the kind of birthplace of Marxism, right? Like, you have Engels, whose dad has a factory there, he's sent to work there and then runs off with a nice Irish girl and learns about radicalism and things, and then writes his book, whose name's obviously immediately eluding me, about... There you go, I've read it and everything. It's not fair, I don't get the credit now. But, like, and you describe that in the book as, like, Marxist urbanism. And I guess, like, how do you differentiate between, like, a Marxist urbanism in the sort of mode of Engels or these sort of later thinkers? Or, like, say, in Bristol, we've got Marvin Rees, who is in the global parliament of city mayors and has just got a new, seemingly made-up job as a professor at the university where he can further research in cities and how, you know, everyone lives in cities and city, and it's just sort of quite trite, liberal kind of, well, everyone lives in cities now, we should think about cities. And, like, well, we should just think about people. Like, yeah, how do you kind of differentiate those two, kind of a Marxist urbanism and a liberal urbanism, then, I guess?
Yeah, so I suppose Engels, like, writes both the condition of the working class in England, which is largely...
why he wrote the book.
He does a sort of tour of industrialising Britain, but he largely focuses on Manchester. And within that, he describes the sort of... the terrible conditions that working people were kind of subjected to in these kind of rapidly urbanising industrial centres. But he also sort of starts to kind of think about how space within cities is, like, made and remade, and how, you know, working class districts are kind of demolished and moved and made way for, you know, a new building is put in, and the kind of, you know, the same social problems that he describes, which are kind of like these cities where, you know, the bourgeoisie basically can kind of live in their bubbles, their kind of segregated bubbles, and not notice the kind of real conditions of the sources of their wealth, the kind of urban working class. And he describes very kind of powerfully, like, factory owners living in kind of suburban South Manchester, travelling into the city centre and then out along these kind of shop-lined avenues. And behind those shop-lined avenues is kind of the real conditions in which the working class live. But they never see it. They kind of live in these kind of segregated spaces. And then he kind of, that's what, in the 1840s? And then later in life, he writes this pamphlet called The Housing Question, where he sort of talks about the relationship between housing and the capitalist system, and sort of the causes of housing, squalor and so on and so forth. So kind of between those things, he's kind of thinking critically about space and urban space and the production of urban space, and linking it to a kind of economic analysis of, like, where capital's moving into factories and production, in a way that, I suppose, you know, that is then developed in the 20th century by people like David Harvey and so on. But I think at the core of it, it's kind of like looking, I guess, as Marx would have done, looking at in the hidden abode of the production of urban space an urban society of like, well, where are the economic and class forces that are shaping districts and neighbourhoods, and why is it that certain people live these kind of wealthy and segregated lives while other people are condemned to squalor? You know, this is not a, I suppose, a natural state of being, but rather the product of kind of economic and class forces. And I suppose that would differ from a kind of liberal analysis that wouldn't necessarily draw back and try and unveil those sort of structural questions, I suppose.
I guess to like dig into, you sort of mentioned David Harvey. This isn't one of the questions I agreed with you before, so I'm ruining the whole premise of this. But like, one of the useful concepts I found from the book was the thing you used with David Harvey. It's about the two circuits.
Yeah.
I was wondering if you, two circuits of capitalism. Like, I was wondering if you wanted to like explain that a little bit. It's a mean thing to put you on the spot about. Is that a mean thing to put you on the spot?
No. Well, I've already sort of said it. I mean, the book's sort of structured in these three parts. And as the kind of structuring idea is this idea of David Harvey. Well, yeah, David Harvey, as one of the people who puts forward this idea of these two circuits of capital. So the first circuit is kind of this idea that, you know, Marx writes about in Capital, where capital kind of circulates through the production of commodities. And David Harvey, building off French Marxist philosopher Gordon Lefebvre, sort of argues that there's also this secondary circuit of capital, where capital kind of moves into a kind of speculative real estate, land, space, and that actually capital kind of switches between the two. So when there's a crisis of productivity in the first circuit, capital will kind of move into the second circuit to try and valorize itself. And I suppose, like, broadly, that helps structure the book because, you know, we can look at cities in the global north that are no, you know, a city like Manchester would have been this kind of, was this industrial city and now is no longer. But global capital is still kind of moving through the city, particularly kind of through the build-to-rent sector. You know, international pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, capital's clearly got an interest in the city, but it's not through production, it's through sort of speculation and rentals.
Cool.
In the secondary circuit. And actually, well, yeah, there's early on in the book, I look at the figure of Richard Cobden, who was a kind of liberal agitator in Manchester, free trader, but also a factory owner himself. And in the 40s, in the 1840s, when there's a kind of slump in factory production, he switches his investments into real estate, and he starts he becomes the secretary of a company that builds one of the first suburbs in Manchester. So that almost in microcosm, in his kind of own personal investment strategies, you see, you know, this broader picture that we've seen unfold certainly since like the 70s in Britain.
And like, yeah, he's one of the examples of, and there's many of this kind of in the book, I'd say, of like throughout the history of this kind of fight over wanting to live in houses that are suitable for living, you know, good, happy, healthy lives. Like, and there's often throughout the book these kind of coalitions of like radicals, later they're communists, earlier they're not, and liberals. And like often, and I think David Cobden was one of the liberals who kind of slightly co-ops and screws over the radicals, or at least takes a lot of the credit, if I recall. Like, what can we do to like mitigate that as radicals in this room? Like, yeah, what is a way to like, given that we do need to work with people and in like Greater Manchester Climate Union and Acorn and stuff, we're working with people who are of varying sort of political backgrounds. Like, what can we do to try and avoid that when that's something that comes up quite often in this work?
I suppose it's so I suppose the book looks at these kind of coalitions, particularly in the early 20th century of like radical liberals and the kind of labour movement that built early suburbs like Wivenshaw and kind of you know, the slum clearance programmes and so on, which sort of had these kind of one of the things the book sort of wrestles with a bit, and you know, I've wrestled with, is the sort of kind of contradictory and slightly ambiguous nature of those kind of slum clearance programs. On one hand, there was this kind of almost utopian desire to provide good sanitary housing, which also came with it a certain paternalism. A lot of these estates that were built didn't have pubs. They were kind of designed as kind of dry areas. Or there was a kind of, a surveillance aspect within the new estates. And also, to build them, they kind of cleared and demolished these kind of long-standing urban kind of working-class communities to do. And not everyone wanted to leave these areas. So there's this kind of all these kind of contradictory things in play. I suppose in terms of like advice from that history.
We always want advice. Just solve the ever-present problem of history.
As radicals or as, socialists or whatever, you need to know why you're in those kind of alliances, I suppose, and what your own standpoint is and what your own base is, and not enter into them blindly. I suppose one of the interesting things actually is liberal, in Manchester, is like liberalism itself has sort of oscillated between, in the 19th century, the Manchester liberals were very like laissez-faire, like let the market, do what the market wants to do. And then in the kind of early 20th century, the kind of key liberal figures kind of move much more in towards a more kind of socialistic kind of perspective. I mean, obviously, the foundation of the welfare state nationally was in part this kind of a radical liberal thing, as well as a kind of socialist kind of labour thing. And certainly, like, key figures within the building of Withenshaw and stuff were liberals, but also sometimes kind of seen as utopian communists or socialists. So, but that's the sort of story of like how liberalism moved, and then obviously liberalism kind of moves back, I suppose, to a kind of neoliberalism, which feels a lot closer to the kind of political perspective of the kind of 19th century liberals. And in Manchester, kind of self-consciously so, that these kind of post-industrial business elites see themselves as the revival of that kind of 19th century Victorian kind of captains of industry, Manchester men type thing. So that's almost the story of liberalism itself, which to some extent is a political tradition beyond that.
I think it gives us, I think it's a good place to sort of come to like, the ultimate place where radicals sell their souls to liberals, which is the Labour Party. And the new urban left, which you talk about, there's lots of sad places now. I know we've all done this. All right. Try everything once. But in the book, you talk a lot about the sort of the new urban left who kind of grow after the 1968, in the 1970s and 80s. Often by the Labour Party, mostly by the Labour Party in this book. And I was wondering if you want to sort of explain a bit about what the new urban left is. And then,
sure.
And there, and I guess there, and how they got defeated might be
the salutary lesson of the new.
Yes, well, they do provide the alternative.
Yeah,
it could have worked. It just wasn't.
I mean, I suppose there's that we were just chatting about that book about Ben Corbyn Abbott.
Oh, Andy Beckett. Yes.
Andy Ben. So I suppose it's that kind of political moment of that, that. A sort of libertarian leftism that emerges out of 68, and both a sort of frustration, political kind of questioning of obviously the right, but also the kind of status nature of the welfare state, and certainly kind of questioning kind of aspects of kind of status leftism, more kind of attuned to kind of liberation movements and kind of this kind of broad kind of coalition that's bringing in liberation movements. And I think also, the change in composition of the Labour Party itself and society, the expansion of the welfare state and the expansion of kind of white collar work, expansion of higher education after the war is kind of changing the kind of social base, and also deindustrialisation itself is sort of taking away that kind of old labour base of the kind of industrial worker. And this, plays itself out on a kind of local level as well as, figures sort of around, Ben and kind of national level. But particularly on a local level, there's a sort of re-engagement with the Labour Party throughout the 70s by people on the left who've sort of felt like the kind of extra parliamentary road has potentially kind of been run, and so there's a kind of switch back into the Labour Party, and you get these kind of new kind of left leaning groups of people taking over constituency parties, running councillor candidates and so on, and by the moment Thatcher's coming to power, the left is also kind of coming to power within local government across Britain. In different kind of, slightly different configurations, the GLC, Sheffield, Manchester, Liverpool. There are these kind of different configurations in which it's happening, but nevertheless, there's this sort of kind of left-wing wave coming into power in local government. And I think you can sort of look at that to some extent as, the policy programmes that they were trying to put forward on a local level were kind of dealing with deindustrialisation, dealing with a sort of sense of, crisis within the kind of welfare state and so on. That thing that Thatcherism was kind of able to almost tap into, it was an alternative attempt to tap into that from the left. and kind of quickly, it comes into confrontation with Thatcher in the 80s, and the book sort of has these kind of three moments of confrontation between Thatcher and sort of kind of bases of, alternative bases of power within society that Thatcher kind of deliberately kind of targets and decomposes. So you've got the urban uprisings in the early 80s, kind of targeting of black communities. You've then got the targeting of the miners and the labour movement, and then in 84, and then by 85, this sort of targeting of local government. And these things are obviously kind of working together. But I think you can sort of see Thatcher's own hegemonic project and her own kind of, political nous, really, that she identified these kind of potential bastions of resistance and kind of took them out through various means. And the big kind of confrontation with the new urban left is the rate capping rebellion of 1985, which is where the kind of left councils basically decide, as a kind of strategy of confrontation, as a way of trying to stop cuts and austerity, that they will refuse to set a rate, a council tax, and in so doing push the government to kind of brinksmanship, where the government will fold and ultimately kind of reverse austerity on local government. And they, in 85, they kind of, Liverpool has already done it in 84, so Liverpool had kind of refused to set a rate, set kind of a legal budget, and faced down the government in 84 and kind of got those concessions. So there was this kind of idea that, across the country they could do this and kind of thing. But it doesn't work, basically. And within Manchester, within Manchester, the left bloc within Labour have kind of come to power in 84, but they never have a majority as the left within the council itself. So the right wing of the Labour Party kind of vote alongside the Tories and the Liberals in the council chamber. And so when they're trying to pass this illegal budget, the kind of right wing of the Labour Party kind of splits off, and they aren't able to pass an illegal budget. And this kind of happens in various ways across the country, and this kind of rate capping rebellion fails. Liverpool and Lambeth kind of go on, and then they're all surcharged. So they kind of, these punitive measures are handed out onto the councils, because not only had the kind of mass rebellion failed and the kind of unity of the councils failed, but also, I spoke to some of the kind of leading figures within the left of Manchester Labour at the time, and they said, by 85, by that kind of key budget setting moment, the miners had already been defeated. So the kind of the moment had passed, the opportunity for kind of proper resistance had already been defeated with the miners' strike, and so this was almost like a foregone conclusion that it would fall apart. And then really the cementing of all that is the 87 election, where Thatcher kind of comes back with a majority again, and you know it's clear that the direction of the country is not going to swing back to the left. And actually, within Manchester, they'd kind of got all this local economic strategy, kind of building up cooperative economy, greater role for kind of trade unions within the local economy. They set up CLES, the Centre for Local Economic Strategies. They kind of set up all this infrastructure, basically, that was almost ready to go in the advent of Labour coming to power in 87, and then Labour don't. And then so it's kind of this moment where, you know, the last chance they thought they had to kind of try this more kind of, you know, cooperatively minded kind of investment, state investment-led response to deindustrialisation is kind of over. And actually the leader of Manchester, it almost very immediately after the 87 election, writes to Nicholas Ridley, the Tory Environment Secretary, and says, you know, you win, basically, and we're going to work with you now. So there's a kind of capitulation after that election. But that is, I suppose, after, you know, 5-6 years of defeat.
Yeah, that's
in different ways.
Graham Stringer, who's like a kind of a fascinating figure in the book, as like a Labour figure who did neoliberal kind of development, as they would call it. But like the difference between him and your kind of you kind of refer to that sort of stuff as proto-Blairism in the book. But the big difference between him and lots of people who kind of came after him in the Labour Party is that he seems to feel, at least from the book, it comes across that he did feel quite bad about doing it. Whereas all these other people work with private companies and were like, oh yeah, this is great, this is how you do it, yeah. And like, yeah, one of the kind of great bits in the book from the kind of new urban left is you mentioned a book called Breaking with Bureaucracy, which kind of advocates for a guerrilla municipalism of like being like guerrilla fighters, taking the bits where capitalism is weak and building these like examples of what socialism can do. Which, in fact, I think is something that was forgotten under Corbynism, given that, you know, there was a Corbynite who ran Wales and we kind of forgot about it. I'm like, oh, we won't try anything there. Lynn's going to tell me that might be wrong. Mm. But like, and then, yeah, so as you kind of have the power of politicians kind of retracting, you have this guy, Bob Scott, who's named Mr. Manchester, who grew up in, was it South Africa and Rhodesia at the time? Like, just the epitome of an 80s bastard, who kind of seems to be this kind of forerunner of a lot of this kind of empowering private entities in the city to kind of, you know, take power. I don't know, I wondered if you wanted to kind of expand on Mr. Manchester a little bit.
Well, just on the breaking the bureaucracy, I think, I can't remember the guy who wrote that, but
I didn't write it down either.
He was a sort of key economic thinker within the GLC, and kind of like came up with a lot of their strategies, basically. And that pamphlet was published by CLES, and it kind of came out, basically. It was obviously commissioned in 84 or late 84, and then it actually came out after the... No, sorry, it would have been commissioned in 86, and then it came out in 87 after the election. So it was almost like already this kind of relic of this world that had already passed, like this idea that you could, you know, create these kind of zones of space that were kind of autonomous from capital, or, you know, where socialist-inspired kind of demonstrations could be done. Already felt a bit kind of anachronistic by the point it was published by CLES.
Because everyone assumed Labour was going to win in 87, right?
Yeah.
Like, I know, it's Alan Moore said that V for Vendetta was too optimistic a book because it was written on the assumption that Labour would win in 87 and then immediately be cooed by fascists.
Yeah.
And he's like, but it was much worse because Margaret Thatcher won.
Yeah. So kind of in response to that, the right, the new right, almost take that concept of zones and use it for the, you know, not zones where, not zones of economic democracy where capital is kind of controlled, but zones where democracy is taken off and capital is allowed to be free. And this is sort of a, you know, this is something the Thatcher administration have sort of been experimenting with since the early 80s. In the aftermath of the uprising in 81, Heseltine sort of writes these papers that says, you know, it takes took a riot. We need to now experiment with creating these urban development corporations, and he does it in Liverpool and in the East London.
And those are the uprisings that were sparked by the riot in St. Paul's in Bristol in 1980.
So that there's already an experimentation on the right, and they are quite explicitly inspired by Hong Kong and, you know, parts of apartheid South Africa. And so, Quinn Slobodian's written this great history of it. But that's all about sort of tearing apart the fabric of, I suppose, the democratic state and creating these spaces where, you know, companies won't be taxed as much where they move to, or, you know, in an extreme example, there would be less labour regulations. Planning law is kind of suspended, so things can be pushed through more easily. And Thatcher is basically persuaded to do this in 81 by, I think, Heseltine or Keith Joseph, who basically says, you know, the people in East London who you will be disempowering, the councils there by doing this, are all communists. So you should do this because it will basically be a way of undermining the power base of our enemies. And again, that's that same theme of like how Thatcher was able to roll out neoliberalism, was through this very kind of almost Gramscian strategy of like taking out her enemies. And by 87, Thatcher sort of makes a turn to the inner city problem and the kind of these questions of municipal socialism. And in her conference speeches in 87, I think, you know, talks a lot about, I think this is the speech she never made because of the Brighton bomb. But she talks about the enemy within, you know, the enemy without, the enemy within. One of the enemies within is these kind of municipal socialists. And so enterprise zones, urban development corporations, as models of how you can change governance within cities, is kind of rolled out across the country. And you know, there's a handful of these urban development corporations. Manchester gets one in the kind of central city. And essentially, the central government says, unless you do this, we won't give you any money for whatever you want to do. So it's like a sort of public funding strike, unless they admit these kind of changes with the structure of how the cities are governed. And typically, the structure is like, you know, there might be a council leader or the council exec, you know, a few officers, but they sit on a board alongside figures from private industry and private sector to kind of administer these projects of, you know, urban regeneration. So in Manchester, they do one for the city centre called the Central Manchester Development Corporation. They do one for the Olympic bid, which is kind of where this guy Bob Scott comes in, because Bob Scott is this kind of
colourful character.
He runs theatres. He set up the Royal Exchange, which is this kind of 70s theatre in the old Royal Exchange. He'd set up cinemas and stuff, but he basically starts to get obsessed with the Olympics in about 85, and particularly the LA Olympics and this idea of the private enterprise games and stuff. And he begins to kind of agitate within Manchester for the city to make an Olympic bid. And he sort of rings up all his contacts in the kind of business world of Manchester and manages to sort of push Graham Stringer into this thing where he's like, yeah, you can make a bid if you want, we're not going to fund it. So this is like 85. Actually kind of concurrently with the rate capping rebellion, Bob Scott's kind of mobilising these figures within the business world around the Olympics. But you can kind of see how by 87, with, you know, the rate capping rebellion defeated and, you know, the municipal socialist agenda kind of gone, this new kind of configuration of forces and people
is ready to pounce
suddenly seems relatively attractive by the leadership, because they're like, oh, well, at least these guys will do something, you know, the city's in a complete crisis, industrialization, and so on. So more and more they sort of become a kind of infrastructure or a network, you know, never necessarily like a formal network, although there are important kind of organs like the Chamber of Commerce, or, you know, the people who are sitting on the Olympic Bid Committee, or later the kind of Human Regeneration Committee, or the City of Drama Committee. Like, these kind of people kind of pop up again and again, doing different projects, And usually the structure of that is that there's a public element, which is usually like some big grant funding from the state, and also like the odd councillor sitting on the board. And then most of it's private, and there's a kind of private delivery and kind of private governance. And you can basically see that as the origins, to some extent, of these kind of public-private partnerships that in Manchester and across the country have become so prominent and so kind of how urban governance is kind of done. So, you know, the IRA bomb in 96 in Manchester is a sort of moment where these same characters, these same forces, this same model kind of becomes the way in which the city centre is kind of restructured after this bomb and after the kind of the impact of that.
I was saying it was interesting that in Manchester your city centre had to get blown up for you to like make it into a neoliberal hellscape, whereas we just sort of covered ours in concrete. I get like Bob Scott sounds a bit like George Ferguson, if I'm honest, the ex-mayor of Bristol. I guess I'll sort of bring us up to the modern day and then sort of come back to you guys then, basically. So you have the sort of rebuilding of the city centre after the 1996 bomb. Then you kind of have, well, the Tories then start, like, eventually come into power and come up with, like, what, the Northern Powerhouse. So how is the Northern Powerhouse a sort of step forward from this kind of old Labour right style or new Labour right style of doing things? And then how does that bring us to the modern day? I'm merging a bunch of questions, but I'll end it with the final, will Andy Burnham save us?
Yeah, I suppose the Northern Powerhouse is almost the kind of, it's not really the culmination, but it's again one of these kind of very typical kind of public-private partnership, you know, not very democratic models that I think the city has become very good at kind of creating. That relationship again with the kind of Tory administration in Manchester, you know, that replicates the kind of relationship that Graham Stringer built up with Heseltine in the late 80s and early 90s. This sort of kind of, you know, the Manchester leadership, the Manchester elite sort of are like, well, we're just pragmatic. We do what's good for the city. We work with anyone. You know, we're not ideological really. Obviously there is an ideology to what they're doing. But the Northern Powerhouse, I think, feels like that kind of thing, just again, really, in that, you know, there were certain things that they wanted to get out of that which were good, like they wanted to re-regulate the buses. But also, in doing that, you know, the whole premise of the Northern Powerhouse, I think, was this kind of property-led regeneration model, HS2 coming to Manchester, you know, creating a certain kind, you know, accelerating the knowledge economy and all these kind of economic strategies that they've been doing. So it was a kind of acceleration of that. I mean, one of the things that's really striking about the Northern Powerhouse is they devolved a kind of £300 million fund, kind of central government-backed loan stock to the combined authority, which basically was used to kind of plug liquidity gaps within private developer house builders' business models, and it was a cheap loan that was then lent back, you know, paid back to the combined authority. There was a FOI done by the BBC only a few months ago, almost £900 million has been lent and returned over the last, well, when was it, 2016. Over half of that has gone to one developer, Renica. And Renica are the developer who made headlines this week for creating the Engels and Turing penthouse suites. They're the ones who built most of the tall towers within Manchester. None of it's affordable. So again, that is that same story that goes back to the 80s of how the state has been restructured and the public kind of acts as a de-risker or a guarantor to private actors to kind of make money out of landlordism. I suppose the other thing about the Northern Powerhouse and devolution is that it is also a sort of smokescreen, I think, for continued austerity. and a sort of general continued attack on like local democracy, because Andy Burnham is obviously elected, but it's a pretty kind of weak mandate. It's just, you know, one election for a single mayor, kind of relatively low turnout. Certainly kind of, you know, much kind of narrower, shallower idea of democracy to even like, you know, a council where you've got councils and so on and so forth, imperfect though they are. But I think you can trace within that, and when I was in Leeds actually, I was chatting to someone who was working in the West Yorkshire Combined Authority, and they were saying it was kind of bizarre because, you know, the West Yorkshire Combined Authority is hiring, you know, there's a kind of buzz around it, but if you talk to anyone in Leeds City Council, it's sort of depressing cuts, you know, everyone's being fired, like they can't do what they want to do. And it's almost like hidden beneath the devolution agenda is a really radical restructuring of local government that actually strips away, you know, a lot of that kind of more democratic elements of local government in favour of these kind of US-style mayors. So it's a sort of smokescreen for ongoing austerity, I think.
Cool.
Really.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Oz. Let's give him a round of applause. All right. And to get your brains working, we're going to give you 2 minutes. Have we got any burning questions immediately?
Or comments?
All comments. We're allowing comments. The oral statement. Oh, yeah.
Okay, I mean, still performing that thing, but there's a few things that we've seen about doing a massive new block here in Bristol Bower Temple, but for students. And obviously, we have our one skyscraper now down by Castle Park. But they're considering a few more, but not really book end for students in that. And the thought was, I was in the podcast talking about private equity companies building just enough houses to sort of keep the contracts, but not enough flats or houses to like bring rents down.
Yeah.
Obviously, they're in control of that. So is there something specific about student flats? You're talking about the money that is like safe or away from that pressure. Do you think that is pressure?
Yes, there is. So PBSA, purpose-built student accommodation, is regarded by investors as what's known as like an asset class investment, which is basically a really good investment, I think. There's actually a really fascinating guy in Manchester who has campaigned against, they're building a 40-storey PBSA block in Manchester near this guy's house. I mean, this guy's not like, he's an ex-Silicon Valley investor who lived in city centre Manchester, but he doesn't like PBSA, but he also is quite an expert on the planning system and kind of how these things have been pushed through. And he also sometimes goes as a secret shopper to investor conferences for PBSA. And basically when he's at these investor conferences, there were like three things, I think, where PBSA is basically seen as a really safe investment. So one, in the planning system, it's classed as a sui generis development, which is basically, it's this kind of legalistic term that means its own, in a class of its own. So basically, if it's sui generis, it's not commercial, it's not residential, it's its own thing, which basically means that they can circumvent minimum space standards, which is, you know, student accommodation, very, very small. From an investor's point, a developer's point, you can put more people paying rent into a smaller space. So that automatically increases the yields you can get. So that's one thing. Two, they're basically tax neutral. So the operation of a PBSA block is, he explained it to me, it's called the OpCo-PropCo split. So the OpCo is the company, so it's basically two companies within one. One company is the operations company, so they manage the lettings, the properties, they're who your student will pay the rent to and so on. The PropCo is the property company, so they own the building. And basically, and I think this is actually, within big developers, this is a pretty common corporate structure now, but they basically move money between these two companies to kind of minimise or move to zero any tax liabilities. So they're able to basically hide any profit so that they pay no tax. So that also means that there's a kind of added incentive. And then the third thing, particularly around PBSA, is the sort of policy context, affordability context, you know, rising in affordability means that more people are being pushed into PBSA. Also, You know, the kind of ultimately, that was the other thing, ultimately the kind of, there's a policy context that backs, the state is backing student loans. So the rent is actually backed by the state. So from an investor's point of view, you know, it will pay no tax. You can put as many people in it as you possibly can. And ultimately, if it goes bust, the state is going to pay you out. So it's a really, really great investment. And you can kind of see, I think you can see PBSA almost as like the cutting edge of actually the whole build-to-rent sector. And in more subtle ways, you know, that those things, those kind of three things are apparent in, you know, the build-to-rent block. But student accommodation is like the absolute golden, you know, midpoint of all this stuff. And that basically means that, you know, investors want to invest in PBSA. They're not going to invest in, you know, even, you know, family housing, because why would you when you can get... And apparently the return on capital is 20%, which he was like, that's like higher than tech. It's like, you know, it's the best thing you can put your money in. And within 5 years, you'll get it all back. So actually, even if within 10 years these buildings fall down, the original investors made their money and doubled it. So it's really perverse, basically, but also exactly what the whole system is set up to reward, which is this kind of venturism. In terms of that question, yeah, I think it's really important. I mean, the last two chapters of the book are a sort of analysis...
Which you haven't read.
I was sort of analysis of contemporary Manchester, because I think... yeah, the city centre boom has been remarkable, skyscrapers, build-to-rent blocks and so on and so forth. To some extent, the city centre was already empty. You know, people didn't really live there. There was a lot of old warehouse, commercial space. And people who defend what's happened will say, well, how can there be gentrification because no one lived there? Or how is this bad because no one used to live there? So, and a lot of the research that some kind of geographer comrades of mine have done into the capital flows into the property market and mainly looking at the city centre boom. But, and you wanted to ask this question,
this, so this is the jump perfect in. Moment.
So then you have to think about, well, what is it? What is happening when you put all that money and capital into the land of the city centre? And how does that ripple out into the inner city? And how does that basically affect the lettings market of the whole city and rents and so on? And one useful way, which is kind of explained in the book, to think about it is this idea of the rent gap, which is a sort of, there's this sort of Marxist urban geographer called Neil Smith, who's a student of Harvey's, who talks about, who gives a kind of economic material analysis of gentrification, not focusing on like, you know, more people are buying lattes or whatever, or shop, you know, different consumption habits, but really like looking back a step and saying, well, how is capital interested in that plot of land now when it wasn't before? You know, what is the macro picture that's like driving investment into certain areas of the city? And really he looks at how, you know, you might have a plot of land where over time the yield out of that land is going down naturally, because maybe its use has changed, it's no longer a factory, it's a warehouse or whatever, or it's running down estate or running down housing. So its rental yield is kind of declining, and then at some point that goes quite low, and then there's a kind of potential rental yield that could be taken out of that land if they put capital into the land. So if they invest in it, if they flatten a building, or if they just like kick out the tenants and put in new tenants, like a new business or a new cafe or you know, a new renter or whatever. So, you know, there's this gap that opens up, and that's the kind of potential. And on a big scale, that could be like a neighbourhood where there's an old council estate that's been basically run down deliberately. Suddenly then it becomes quite attractive to kind of flood capital in, flatten that and build something else that will get better rent yield. On a micro scale, it could be like a family house is turned into an Airbnb or a HMO. You know, you have to make some investments to turn a family house into an HMO, you have to like knock down walls and stuff, but the rental yields are much higher. And basically when that gap gets big enough, that sort of provides the incentive for capital to kind of come in and close the gap. And that kind of is how capital like moves through a neighbourhood. And like landlords are actors, but the state's also an actor or a developer, like there's all sorts of different actors. But that sort of rippling effect is kind of how gentrification happens in a kind of like material sense, and you can literally like see that in a neighbourhood, like you can see it around here.
And it creates perverse incentives, right? If you've got all your councillors enmeshed with people who build things, and that's their model of like making areas better, but they're also the people who need to like. I mean, there was an example in a tower block in Bristol where like people are selling drugs in our hallway. So the council made a rule that no one was allowed to visit you in your flat, so people couldn't hang out and sell drugs in your hallway. They then didn't do anything to stop the people selling drugs in the hallway. And you go, and if all that makes the people building the houses, which is them going, look what we did, and that's your model for like gentrification, you can see why that, even if they're not doing that consciously, there's that drive. To be fair, as a man with this beard and these ears drinking herbal tea in Stokescroft, I'm glad that we've got a Marxist economic explanation for gentrification and not a cultural one. Is there any other questions while I keep rambling?
There's an article in the Financial Times recently about
Blackstone,
you know, getting all these private experts coming in and buying up these kind of private rental market, basically, as part of their portfolio. It's increasingly, I've seen huge amounts of money kind of from private equity going into there. There's an interesting quote here from someone. Institutional private capital can play an important role in providing high-quality housing stock across the UK, particularly in the private rented sector, which is significantly undersupplied today, said James Heppelhoff, head of European real estate at Blackstone. So, like, to what extent, I mean, you kind of talked about the two circuits of capital, right? And to what extent do you see this huge flood of capital coming from private equity as symptomatic of the, as a lack of opportunities in productive capital investment, first of all, and secondly, you know, is this actually going to accelerate the trends we've been seeing recently? Are we now going to get a supercharged version of what you've been describing?
And then one from Lynn. I will say, now that we're talking about things like equity and all that malarkey, if anyone doesn't know what anything means, wave at us and ask, and it's fine. I couldn't tell you the difference between equity and other things, so I'm asking. But Lynn,
I just want to answer that one directly because I'll give a perspective.
All right, let's go.
Sure.
What's equity, first of all?
Equity. It's like.
Private equity is just like
liquid
capital. Yeah, okay. Yeah, it's just like people have got loads of money, they lend it, they give it to these bankers, hedge funds, whatever it is, they'll go invest it in a portfolio of different assets, which generates them hopefully an above inflation rate of return. Right?
Cool.
Yeah, they're trying to get a return above what you get from just putting your money into an index fund or something. Right? They're trying to get like an alpha, is what they call it. They're trying to get above.
Sweet. Yeah. Thank you.
That's like above if you just put it in a savings account.
Right.
Yeah. He said index, and you saw everyone go, I don't know what index.
I'm no expert on this. I think you're probably right that it is, you know, for whatever reason, you know, capital is more interested in this because it creates higher yield than, you know, doing anything productive or useful, like, you know, decarbonising or whatever. But that is also there's a political framework that's been put in place to mean that is kind of where the incentives are going, and that probably is, that's the thing about the neoliberal thing, is that the kind of political legalistic state framework has been used in the kind of role of the public sector and the state to change the. It's not been retreated, it's been kind of modified to kind of change the way in which the economy is working. I think, it probably will get a lot worse if these actors move into the housing market. I think it goes back to the thing about PBSA, that there are, and it goes back to this thing of like all the incentives, the legalistic framework, the fact that the government won't tackle private landlordism, private landlordism that was deliberately created in the 88 Housing Act to create a profitable private rent sector, the fact that no one's going to fund council house building or remunicipalisation or anything like that, it just means that the framework within everything is operating tends towards one, this kind of affordability crisis, but then at the same time, the only solution that is kind of entertained in policy circles is by a massive expansion in supply funded by private equity. because the other things are not considered. So that means that, you know, almost by us talking about how bad the housing crisis is, the discursive framework has been set for, you know, ripping up planning regulations, building a massive expansion in build-to-rent supply, high quality rental housing. It's like, you know, the framework is in place to allow this to happen, and unless you were to change the political economy of this, you know, I think this is the direction things are going.
Yeah, go on, I said other people, because
it's always going to frame this as an issue of shortage of supply. Do you can see that as actually being the issue? Because, I mean, there's more empty homes than homeless people in the UK, right? There is actually, I mean, obviously the thing with urbanisation is, I guess, that perhaps there is a lack of housing in the places where you need housing, where jobs are, like London and so on. But, like, I feel like it's less an issue of supply and more an issue of ownership, right? Like, to what extent is private landlordism actually part of the reason why there's... The way they frame it now is, like, well, there's an issue in the private rental market, like, there's not enough suppliers. Well, if more people could afford houses, there wouldn't be so much demand in the private rental market, right? Because it wouldn't be being hoarded by private landlords.
Seems like it might be more of a comment than a question, which is fine, but does it really need an answer?
I would agree with you, basically. I think the supply argument has been the perfect tool for, like, real estate activists, basically property developer activists, to say, look at this crisis we're facing. The only solution is to rip up planning regulations and allow property developers to do whatever they want. Whereas actually you can kind of take it back and say, well, why, you know, private landlordism, destruction of the public sector, housing, etc. is like, yeah, but it's really, you know, I don't think on the left we've been very good at combating that, basically. I think it's slightly taken us all a bit by surprise. But, you know, this is clearly the framework that's going to govern the urban agenda of the incoming Labour administration, unfortunately. And you know, if you look at somewhere like Manchester, run by Labour Council, you know, the YIMBY capital of Britain, you can see why this is almost prefiguring, you know, I think what Reeves and Starmer are keen to see happen in other places.
On the framework, it was really interesting in the book talking about how you weren't allowed to challenge planning things at the council level using political language. Like, you weren't allowed to, like, talk about gentrification or that it was changing the character of the area, so you had to use a legalistic kind of language. It sort of feeds into what you were saying there. I will add, I realise I've been heckling people who've asked questions. They are people I sort of know, and so if I don't know you, I probably won't heckle you. I know, that's bad chairing. Lynn, do you want to...
Yeah, no, sure. Thank you. Yeah, I've come all from Cardiff, and it's very interesting to see the circa three cities, all of which are part of this core city group that they talk a lot about. I visited Manchester for a few days last year. It was the first time I'd been there for 20 years. And I think the last time I'd seen it, there'd been the one vertigo building, you know, the one that looked as if it was toppling over, but you can't see it anymore because it's surrounded by so many other towers. I mean, it is quite remarkable. In terms of so a lot of what you're saying is very familiar to what we've seen in Cardiff in the past 7, 8, 9 years particularly, and it's interesting you said there'd been an acceleration in the last decade, and there certainly has in Cardiff. The build-to-rent model is becoming the favourite. And there's a lot of big finance in them as well as equity capital. Legal in general are very big players in central Cardiff. And it's, for them, it's a steady stream of income. And I agree with what you were saying on PBSA, but in a sense, the sort of build-to-rent is almost a grown-up version of PBSA, isn't it? You know, and the way planning works and viability arguments, effectively they're guaranteed a 15-20% return on developments. Otherwise they say, oh, we can't afford to do this, and so sort of back down. So the political context is a little bit different. Wales didn't really have that big urban left in the 1980s. It was all very, the history of Wales, it was all very much on heavy industry. You know, steel workers were defeated in 1980, the miners were defeated in 1985, and that sort of set a political tenor for a lot of things. And Cardiff certainly became heavily deindustrialised in the the generation since then. We did have the Cardiff Bay Development Corporation, which was like Cardiff's equivalent of what was being done in, like I said, on a very large scale for a relatively small city, with the huge barrage being built and all the transformation of the bay and all of that. And then the investment stopped, more or less, around about just after 2000. And then, as I said, it's kicked up again in the past decade, and we're certainly getting a lot of the towers. You know, ours are 20 to 30 rather than yours 40 to 50, but you know, they're all coming in. One difference we do have is that the Welsh Government has abolished right to buy. All right? And that does make something of a difference, because it's allowed some councils, Cardiff being one of them, to actually build council houses in a kind of partnership with the private sector, but nonetheless it is building council houses and renting them out on a council basis. And financially it makes perfect sense, I mean, particularly when interest rates were rock bottom, because it was guaranteed that they would pay for themselves all the time, and you would help to solve the housing crisis as well. So that does help. It does help that you can say, you know, we're letting this private development go ahead, and there's not going to be any affordable housing in there, but there is a piece of land near it that we can use for council housing. So it's not quite as... but as far as I can tell, Starmer's basically given up on the prospect of abolishing right to buy. And if there's one thing we should have learned over 100 years now, is that it's only large-scale public sector building that can solve whatever the housing supply issue is, because there is a housing supply issue of affordable housing, there's no doubt about that.
Yeah,
there's
yeah.
An overall supply issue is another matter, but certainly with affordable housing there is a shortage, and the reasons for that are complex. They're partly financial, they're partly the fact that we just don't build houses at the rate we did 40 years ago.
Wales also experimented with Dublin council tax on
Town homes.
That was outside of the city.
You can now actually go up to four times council tax.
Fuck the England.
So that's potential for both second homes and for long-term empty homes as well. Partly driven by concerns in parts of Wales about the impact on Welsh-speaking communities of high numbers of tourists and so on buying up. But It has been adopted in cities as well. Cardiff's now going to go up to a 200% levy on empty and second homes, which is obviously, I mean, it's intended to both encourage those owners to sell so that those properties then go into the wider market, but also to raise revenue that's supposed to be directed into building social housing. Mm-hmm.
Social housing. Yes, the Welsh thing, especially South Wales, housing associations, do you know a lot of Welsh councils, they are really on it. I don't know, Wales did get a lot of EU funding. We've lost out badly on that. Wales has lost out badly on the EU funding. No, it's not. Wales is really well out of it. But yes, social housing is really good, you know. Yeah, no, no, they're, you're, you're, in Wales, I'll talk to one of my councils about it. But a question for you then, I'll answer it.
One of the issues that we certainly have in the Cardiff area is Cardiff and the capital region. Because there is a lot of investments in Cardiff, but there isn't in the wider area. You know, and the difference between Cardiff and Ebbw or Rhondda and Merthyr and so on is very pronounced. And the only solution that seems to be put in is, let's have better transport links so people can travel down to Cardiff to work. And I was wondering what, you know, Manchester and its surrounding areas, what the relationship there is.
It's pretty similar, particularly the kind of north east of the borough, of the region. These kind of ex-industrial towns, pretty, you know, poor, multiple, you know, really economically uneven. Manchester's slightly different because the south is quite affluent, so like Cheshire, Old Trafford. And I actually think that's probably the secret as to why Manchester is actually been able to be. So when I was in Glasgow, what was really striking was that, you know, Glasgow City Council have almost tried the Manchester thing but failed, because there isn't enough demand in the kind of, there isn't, people don't have enough money to spend money. They can't do a consumer-led regeneration of like bits of central Glasgow because people just don't have the money. Whereas probably the secret to what's happened in Manchester is that there is this kind of southern peripheral belt, both of like, you know, middle class landed footballers and so on, but also kind of skilled working class. You know, there is still kind of elements of industrial production in kind of defence, pharmaceuticals, all down around Runcorn and stuff like that. There is these kind of little productive pockets where I think Manchester's probably been able to say, well, come and spend your money here, to a lot of, to these kind of hinterland to the south. But certainly, like, even within the city of Manchester, like the north of the city is some of the most deprived wards in England. Yeah. So it's hugely uneven. And again, that goes back to, you know, Engels and what Engels was saying about these, you know, street to street, it's just completely different worlds. I was just going to say that the sort of, as well as the first circuit, second circuit kind of meta-narrative, there is another one, which is this kind of rentier city in the Victorian era, where, you know, you had slums and suburbs being built by private capital and kind of, you know, free market to some extent, and like land and, you know, no controls over landlordism. The 20th century sort of abolishes that to some extent with kind of controls over planning and landlordism and public housing. So there's a kind of abolition of the rentier. And then the neoliberal period is like its resurrection. And I think that's quite an interesting time frame to think about the current housing crisis within, because I think we often think, and actually, you know, if you've read, followed any of Nick Baino's recent stuff, he actually takes the same time frame in that, you know, I think often we think of the last 50 years and the rollout of neoliberalism and the decline of the social democratic compact. But actually, it's sort of like the situation now is akin to that, like, 1880s in cities where it was a kind of free market, you know, free for all. And the response of that was like squalor, in the same that we have today, like people live in squalor in extreme poverty because there is no regulation of the market. And I guess that uneven economic geography is sort of a feature of how capitalism, if uncontrolled by anyone else, just moves through space. Like uneven development is sort of in its nature, really.
I was wondering. Oh, yeah.
I think I'll follow this thought. I was wondering, you know, much about how like all these changes affected people who work in construction. It's like, from what I know, like, people who, you know, talk to work and things like that, who are linked up or around. One thing is that there's loads and loads more agency work, and how that affects kind of their safety and the precariousness of their work, and how much they're able to even, like, you know, form union blocks and fight for their conditions. Also, the fact that young, you know, mostly lads, starting in the industry thinking it's all the same as it ever was, and then when they go into it and they maybe do an apprenticeship, maybe just having a bit of a go, getting their first job, and they don't actually get trained in the skills that they want. So not only is safety not up to scratch, and they don't even know that it's not where it should be, but also they don't even come out of these jobs that they're doing with kind of the skills that they would once get. They don't get taught properly for the next job they're doing. They don't have that kind of basis to work on. Some of them might work out if they've got the right person, but it's just so much more precarious, and it doesn't build that skill set that they can then, do you know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
How much you came across that knowledge?
I actually, it's something that I think I would like to know a lot more about, the kind of labour relations of, like, the people actually building the towers. All I know is what you've just said, really, that, you know, it's lots of blacklisting, very casualised, and so on, really. I don't have any particular insight. There was like a wildcat strike of construction workers in Manchester a few years ago, as I recall, where they, like, I think they moved their machinery onto the motorway and kind of blocked. I can't really remember the details, but it was quite dramatic. I think, it would be something to definitely look more into, basically.
So I will come to you in a second. There were some hands over here. Was it? I'll take both of you then. You first, because you hand up first, and then you at the back.
I was just wondering if you could say something about the investment that's been coming into Manchester from the Gulf States and how that's all going and what impact that's
had. Yeah. Go on, I'll take those on.
I just wondered as well, if you could say about the kind of the trend towards growing, building large, sprawling, rather soulless housing estates on the outskirts where they're kind of deserts during the day because everybody just leaves and commutes elsewhere. And then they just come back, and there's no interest in them to get like your takeaway and maybe a Wetherspoons or something. That's about it, and there's nothing else there. And people just go home after work, live in these places, and then they commute out, and they're kind of housing designed by the Borg.
It was the 2019 election. I didn't know Bristol had so many. And you go, oh, you technically live in the same city as me, but we have a very different time of it. Yes.
Why is that? Not trying to ask you to predict the future, but it is sometimes easy to think about.
England will lose in the Euros.
Is there a point where this sort of falls apart? Because there's sort of some signs that maybe like they're just not going to get enough students to come here, or that something like that happens, or birth rate falls. Or something. Is there something, a confluence of factors you can see? And then, because that could also inform political strategy, because if there's something sort of happening anyway, then we can push at it a little bit harder.
Well, you're already seeing that in universities, right? I mean, Bristol's interesting because they just said they've had 40% more people register than previously. But I know I work for the UCU in Cardiff, and there, like, especially because the government is being so strident against international students, and basically saying they don't want them, even though they've set up a system where all the universities, which pay for the cities, need them. Lots of them are going, all right, fuck it, I won't come then. And I think there is a good chance it's going to, like, really fuck up a lot of the cities. Not Bristol. Well, it will fuck us up, just in a different way.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, someone told, one of my geographer comrades said that up to a third of the build-to-rent renters in Manchester are students or international students. So it's like, and Manchester has the largest, one of the largest student populations in as a proportion of the city's population. I think it's a big fragility, probably. I suppose the thing is, if it does sort of bust on the current model, these things will probably just be repackaged and sort of rented out to slightly different groups of people with slightly different rental levels. And, the financing of it will change slightly, but they'll adjust their profit margins. But essentially the thing will kind of keep going. But, I think it's pretty fragile in some ways. The Place Northwest, which is like the property magazine of the Northwest, it's pretty good for like reading what they're thinking. We're saying, is Manchester and the Northwest particularly exposed in the whole property industry because it is really built around this university and there's so many university students? And they said maybe. But I suppose that's one of these big, what is it, Sue Gray has her shit list for when Labour come in, where one of them is like higher education going bust. And I suppose that is one of the, if major universities start to fall apart, the central government will probably step in and bail them out because it's pretty crucial to like the whole system that's been constructed.
Wasn't in your book, isn't it, something like 30% of the money going through Manchester is via the university or something like that? Like it's
The sort of economic product, the zone of the city which is most productive is that kind of university zone. But, most a higher proportion of that productivity gain has been creamed off by capital through rents rather than, like, wage increases.
No more questions. We've got two more questions to answer. So it was Borg houses.
Yeah, are they new ones?
Golf money.
Good one. is that, like, new estates or old estates?
Well, they seem to be new, yeah. I mean,
like Barrett Home stuff.
North Bristol, really.
Yeah. I mean, they're sort of just a symptom of like private house builders having all the power, I think, that they can kind of build these estates. But then I suppose there's also, you know, a lot of those overspill estates in the 50s that were, you know, Manchester City Council built big overspill estates. I think Bristol did as well.
There seems to be plenty of them who were not happy to talk about Corbyn in 2019.
So the sort of flip side of the slum clearance programmes was these overspills, which also often lacked in amenities. It's almost this like kind of peripheral, what's the word?
Well, I guess if you don't...
It's a recurring theme of like how British planning and urbanism is, that it creates these kind of peripheralised estates that are sort of like...
If you have no say over where you... Like, you have to live there because that's where the work is, but you have no say over what's built or what's there, then you just need your house, your shop, your Wetherspoons, and your one delivery driver will drive up to you.
Sometimes they don't even have a Wetherspoons there.
I mean, my hometown only just got Deliveroo. But like... And that's all, if you have no recourse to demand anything back, that's all you're going to get, right? The bare bones, all like joint, because...
It seems like it's a sort of failure of public planning, really, of like planning for communities, neighbourhoods and, you know, people. You know, house builders have such amount of power, you know, they land bank, they kind of basically control the supply of housing, you know, these Barrett home estates and stuff like... They control what they look like you say, but unless you've got a sort of regulatory, public-spirited authority of planning to sort of go against that, you know, that's sort of what will be created, I would say.
Golf money.
Yeah, so... So Manchester Life is this sort of development corporation, public-private partnership between the council and the Abu Dhabi United Group, which is like sort of the sovereign wealth fund of Abu Dhabi. Same group that owned the football club. In about 2013-14, the council signed this deal with the football club's owners to build build-to-rent housing in East Manchester. And this is the neighbourhood of Ancoats that we've been mentioned. That was a neighbourhood that actually in the Blair years had had a council estate that was kind of flattened, and Urban Splash, it was kind of like archetypical kind of Manc property developer company, were given the contract to sort of build this new model canal-based neighbourhood in East Manchester over the ruins of this council estate. But that all fell apart with the financial crisis. So there was sort of for 5 years after 2008 or longer, 5 to 7 years maybe, you know, half completed neighbourhood where there was like a block and then like wasteland. So the council basically, to get that regeneration agenda going, because there was no central government money, because it was not because of austerity and stuff, turned to Abu Dhabi as the kind of source of capital to get this thing running again. And they basically developed, I think, 1,500 built-to-rent flats in East Manchester, in Ancoats. The rent, I think, the deal was basically the council gave public land and obviously the kind of political planning frameworks to ensure that these things would be built. Abu Dhabi provided the capital, and then the rents all go offshore through Jersey to Abu Dhabi. The Sunday Times, maybe like 4 years ago, calculated as about £10 million a year in rent going offshore. I think, you know, the Abu Dhabi relationship has got quite a lot of attention, rightly so, because obviously it's the ethics of who the council is partnering with and so on. But in a way, it's sort of symptomatic of the much broader build-to-rent phenomenon, because, you know, obviously on one level there's the kind of ethical questions of who the money's going to, but in terms of like rentierism and build to rent, you know, whether it's an Australian pension fund or the Abu Dhabi government, or you know, a new big partnership is with the Far East Consortium, which is a sort of, it's basically where Chinese middle class put their money in a kind of investment fund based in Hong Kong, and the council's done a deal with loads of land in North Manchester to build 15,000 units of housing. But all of those things are basically showing, you know, people's wages being sucked out of the city via rents. So in terms of that rentier thing, they're all as bad as each other. But obviously there are additional ethical questions about Abu Dhabi. But the council basically say, well, it was a deal we had to strike to get our regeneration agenda moving again. And we didn't charge for the land because we figured that that was a fair price to kind of get this flagship urban regeneration neighbourhood going again. That's obviously a contested point, but that's what the council say. But yeah, so it's a particular kind of construct and relationship. At the moment, I don't think there's much else planned, but I imagine, you know, there's a lot of development happening around the city stadium. There's also the council want to get rid of Strangeways Prison. Because that kind of area of land to the north of the city, you know, could just be opened up to like new frontiers of speculation. And Abu Dhabi was sort of in the picture to maybe get that contract at some point. So it's one to watch.
I'm quite aware we've not spoken too much about Bristol in front of Atman. You know, I think I'd add that, like, you know, if you think Bristol's escape is kind of hollowing out of democracy, like I don't think, like the kind of one of Marvin's big things was like the one city plan, which was him meeting up with business leaders. One of the things they were going to do was build a mass transit system, which was vetoed by Dan Morris. So we won't have that. We might still get, you know, what the other things they wanted, which was trucks driven by AI and things delivered by drones by 2050. So that'd be nice. But that is like instead of councillors, that was meeting up with the business elites. Similarly, like culture in Bristol is entirely funded by like Business West, which is again removed from any democratic accountability. Bristol Transform could never get money from Business West because we talk about how you could change stuff, and that's not allowed. It's political. You just have to like write sad poems about how it is a bit bad, but it's ugh, what are you going to do? So like I think Bristol is as bad for this anyway, and you see that in the like the arena moving out. The city, even the zoo.
Consumerism. Yeah, hyper consumerism.
Yeah.
Everything is driven by consumers, and it's key to the positive touch on the government when you say that her strategy to remove the communists, just to also strip people from the citizen. Mm-hmm. We are not with our citizens, but consumers. And everything is being driven by that. And I've seen this critically growing in Bristol.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm looking for a proper Bristol pub, like a proper pub. I mean, you need to go really out of the schools.
Yeah, that's it. It's the flattening of public life, and it comes from the fact that you have no kind of recourse for these things. But rather than end us on the downer, I'm going to ask you my final question. So you're involved in Greater Manchester Tenants Union. Right? In Bristol, we've got the Mighty Acorn. I'm pointing at Rachel. Hi, Rachel. But like, what can tenants unions do to like help fight back against this? Are they, as we're sort of currently in a phase where probably we're not going to be in the Labour Party, you know, we don't think it's coming to save us. Andy Burnham is not going to come and save us. Like, what can tenants unions and community unions and things like that, why are they a useful tool for trying to fight back against some of this or kind of expand understanding of how these things work? And I guess, like, first, like, how does a book like this and the history that you kind of laid out, how does that feed into that sort of strategy of fighting back?
Mm.
So we can end on a high.
Well,
goodbye.
The guy, Hamish Callan, who I did the event in Edinburgh with, said every city should have a book like this. So there was a challenge for someone to write the Bristol book, who's here in the audience tonight. I think demystifying these processes of like urban government is quite useful because it really shows the sort of lack of democracy and you know how it all really works. And when you do that, you can start to scrutinise, you know, the planning system and, you know, trying to track who's meeting who. And then if you can get a better mapping picture of it, including mapping land and land sales and stuff, we've been using this tool called Land Insight. Which is actually a tool the developers use to sort of map land ownership. But I can imagine, you know, tenants' unions, community groups, land trusts, using this tool in a kind of offensive strategy. Because a lot of this is like, it's about, there's a really good kind of radical architecture practice in London called Unit 38, who've done quite a lot of work around the Latin Village campaign in Tottenham. And the guy behind that, you know, a lot of it's all about territory. It's about claiming the territory, advancing onto territory. You know, we can act as they do as well. You know, defensively through the tenants' unions, stopping evictions, stopping developments. And I kind of increasingly think, you know, militant strategies against, you know, if they're building a big build-to-rent development in the neighbourhood that is a working-class neighbourhood, you know, fight it at planning, but then, you know, use the law, you know, use tactics perhaps beyond the law to slow it down. If there's a kind of mass campaign around that, you know, there are all sorts of ways you can slow down this kind of gentrification frontier. So I think that's the kind of stuff that I imagine tenants' unions should be able to have that function of, like, it's not just the tenant-landlord relationship, it's also about, like, space and territory and, you know, this all gets a bit theoretical, but, like, basically, you know, which classes are able to exert power and control over neighbourhoods? Is it, you know, working-class people in the neighbourhood, or is it developers or whatever trying to extract wealth from the neighbourhood? So I think there's all that. And then I think, yeah, obviously, kind of turning to a kind of land-based strategies. I mean, it's just community land trust. That's good. The zone, the politics of the zone, I think we can still use kind of fruitfully to try and counter some of this. But I think at the moment it is probably a bit of a defensive battle, unfortunately. It's one that we should fight.
No, I think that's spot on. Like, you know, like you said, like in Bristol you can join ACOM. Like, as you talk about zones, like there's the St. Paul's, well, no, the Eastern and St. Paul's apartheid free zone is being revived as a tactic from the 1980s of, like, exerting that, you know, these communities are our communities and that they're going to be run as we say. I think that's a really powerful thing. What's this?
I'll leave a copy. I don't have many, but I'll leave one as a sort of, but it's online on our website. It's just a really useful guide about how you can sort of do all sorts of research into developers, landlords.
Oh, yeah. Sweet. I will get
the
Isaac.
The people of Manchester, the people of Bristol.
I will get this Isaac. Thank you very much. To either send me this
PDF, yeah.
Or put it in the Bristol Transformed Brain Trust on Facebook and the Land Insight as well. If we put together a little toolkit on this sort of stuff, I think that'd be awesome. But I'll stop talking now. Well, I won't, but, you know. We're going to go and drink in the Bell Pub next door after this, and we can talk about how great Bristol could be again. But without further ado, let's give Isaac Rose a massive round of applause. You can buy the book for him, buy the book, buy the book, down here. There will be another event next month on Capitalism, a Horror Story, looking at capitalism through the lens of horror films and how it tears us apart, as Marx described it in Capital, linen woven out of the guts of children. It's a great line, very metal. But yeah, buy Isaac's book, see us next month. There's
Thanks
always stuff to get
everyone
involved in. Join ACORN.
Stay in touch, join ACORN, yeah.
Yeah, join the Greater Manchester Tenants Union if you want to be weird. Yeah. But yeah, thank you very much, man. Yeah, we'll go for a good one.